You can get custom tiles for your kitchen or custom colors for your family room. Now journalist John Mo Allam reports Americans willing to pay for it are getting custom-made pets. Mo Allam's piece in Sunday's New York Times Magazine focuses on designer dogs like the Labradoodle, born of a Labrador and poodle, or the Puggle. Want to guess? That's a pug and a beagle. Mo Allam finds the trend is drawing criticism from dog breeding traditionalists and raising questions about our relationship with man's best friend. John Mo Allam is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. His pieces have also appeared in Harper's, The Nation, and Salon.com. Last Friday, when Dave Davies was hosting Fresh Air, he recorded this interview with Mo Allam.
Well, John Mo Allam, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You write in this piece that designer dogs became popular about a decade ago. What exactly is a designer dog?
A designer dog is really a lot of things to a lot of different people. When I said that it really became popular a decade ago, that's really talking about a dog called the Labradoodle, which is, in this country is largely a crossbred dog of a purebred Labrador retriever and a purebred poodle. You put those two dogs together and the litter of puppies you get are Labradoodles. And that's sort of the way it's gone on with people crossing different dogs, purebred to purebred, and then just sort of mashing the two breed names together and coming up with a kind of cute label for it, like a Maltipoo, which would be a Maltese and a poodle, or a Puggle, which would be a pug and a beagle. And it's just sort of gone on exponentially from there in kind of this free-for-all of people combining these different breeds.
You know, it takes some effort to do this. What were the breeders trying to accomplish?
Well, the first people to do a Labradoodle, actually, this happened in Australia in the 80s. And as I understand it, the breeder who did, the first quote-unquote Labradoodle was working to breed a dog that would be a guide dog for the blind, but would also work for a particular woman with very bad allergies. So he actually took hair samples from different dogs, I think mostly poodles, trying to find a sample that this woman's allergies could tolerate. And, when he found a couple that seemed workable, he then bred that one of those dogs to a Labrador, which is, typically one of the dogs used as guide dogs. But what happened in Australia was that other breeders picked up on this and they sort of tried to build an actual breed of dog that was the Labradoodle. And the way you do that is you take that first litter of hybrid puppies of poodle crossed with Labrador, and then you pick out the ones that you like. You look for whatever traits you want, either the temperament or the particular kind of coat, and you start breeding them together. Maybe you'll breed one to another breed of dog, kind of tweaking what you see in each generation. And as you go down the line, eventually, as you're inbreeding and bringing in new breeds and just kind of honing the subsequent generations, you end up with a line that breeds true. And that means that you'll be able to take two Labradoodles, put them together, have them have a litter of puppies, and those puppies will really have those traits that you've been trying to fix in the line.
And so at that point, you have no longer a hybrid. You have a new breed, right?
Right. And people are doing this all the time. I mean, there's breeders who are, constantly founding new breeds. But this has been going on really since the late 1800s when people started, really seriously breeding what we now think of as purebred dogs. But what happened with the Labradoodle, though, was the Australian breeders who had done this then started exporting those dogs to the U.S. As pets. Here they had a dog with what they felt was a great friendly temperament. It was a relatively non-shedding dog, so it didn't make much of a mess. It was good with people with allergies. And they'd put all this hard work into it, over about a decade of getting these dogs just the way they wanted them, that they, put a price tag on it of $2,000 or $3,000, and people started buying them here. In some ways, it was kind of a big misunderstanding how the designer dog craze started in this country, because what happened was, American breeders, people who were breeding purebred dogs, for pet stores or selling them directly through the internet, suddenly saw this thing called the Labradoodle. It cost $2,500. It seemed obvious how you made one. It was right there in the name. You took a Labrador and a poodle. And people kind of misunderstood that's all it was. That's all the Australians had done. So they would, take their Labrador, maybe go next door to their friend who had a poodle, breed a Labradoodle, and try to sell it for $2,500, $3,000. And it worked. It largely worked.
What were some other combinations that you found interesting or intriguing?
Well, you know, some of the most interesting combinations are the ones that seem like two really different dogs. I met one man in Denver who had actually never bred dogs before, and he was just looking to get himself a pet. And he ended up breeding a poodle to a Rottweiler, and he called it a Rottle, a standard poodle on a Rottweiler. And, you know, this is a guy, he worked for the post office, he really had no experience breeding dogs, and over about 5 or 6 years of visiting breeders and trying to find what he would consider to be the perfect pet, and sort of being very disillusioned by the whole, you know, culture of the show dogs and show breeders, just decided that he would breed up over a period of years. He dug deep into the interlibrary loan program of the Denver Public Library, came up with some really interesting reading and talked to people, and ended up crossing these two dogs. And you know, honestly, when I looked at the dog, I couldn't really tell that there were any specks of poodle or Rottweiler in it. It was really its own thing. It sort of goes to show you that you can't really tell what a dog is going to turn out like until you do that first cross.
And did the Rottle, is that what we call it, did it have behavioral characteristics? I mean, did the guy get what he was looking for?
Yeah, I think he did. He was really looking for, you know, ironically, because he was working for the post office, he really was looking for a really confident guard dog, which I'm sure angered a lot of his colleagues at the Postal Service. But he did. He felt that, and I met some of the puppies. I mean, it's hard to tell only spending an afternoon with the dogs. But he did feel, out of the 10 puppies that he had seen, you know, a very trainable dog with some of the qualities of the poodle, with also some of the confidence of the Rottweiler. I think it's really important to point out that so much of this is subjective. And that's, you know, something I get at in the piece, is that I really think ultimately a lot of the appeal of these dogs is almost kind of a Rorschach-like quality to them. You know, here's this thing, we've given it a name, we don't quite know what it is yet, it doesn't have a reputation, and we're free to see what we want to see in it. If we want to see, you know, the temperament of a poodle, you know, oh, I knew a poodle once and it was sweet, and this dog is sweet, so that must have come from the poodle. You know, we're free to do that. The scientific reality of it, you know, is far more complicated, and so much of it has to do with the individuals who are breeding the dogs themselves and their scrupulousness, their good taste in terms of selecting, you know, high quality parents, screening for health problems, screening for behavior. You know, so much of what a dog turns out like is dependent on the whims and the practices of the people breeding it, that it's almost a bit of a red herring to say that, you know, to give these breeds or designer dogs names and assume that, you know, all Puggles will be the same, or, you know, all Pugs or all Peagles will be the same for that matter.
You know, some of these breeds that are being combined are pretty different. I mean, we picture the Rottweiler and the poodle. Does the breeding occur naturally in these animals, or is artificial insemination frequently needed?
Right. Well, in most of, I would assume in all, and certainly in the vast majority of the designer dogs, the dogs are breeding naturally. The trick, so to speak, is to use the larger dog as the mother. If you do that, then you'll be able to have the dogs, you know, manage the procreation on their own, and then but more importantly, you'll have the puppies in the womb adapt to the size of the mother, so that generally you'll have a size and shape of puppy that can fit through the mother's birth canal.
Right.
Where you run into issues with artificial insemination or C-sections is with purebred dogs. There are many breeds of purebred that you know, can no longer procreate on their own reliably without human intervention, or that, you know, have to have virtually all of their puppies delivered by C-section because, you know, the puppies just can't cram down the birth canal. It's too narrow at this point.
And that's because the breeding over the centuries has exaggerated their physical features such they just can't do nature's tricks anymore?
That's right. We, you know, people, breeders have latched on to a certain description of the dog, a certain vision of what the perfect dog of each breed would look like. And over 150 or 100 years of selecting for that shape and those proportions, You know, they've really exaggerated a lot of those qualities. They've really come up with some kind of more dramatic geometries of dogs. And yeah, it does get to a point where they can no longer do their only biological function.
And which breeds are most misshapen this way?
Well, it's my understanding that it's a lot of the smaller breeds where you find examples of this. I know, for example, the pug is a great example of a dog that, the quote unquote best bred pugs, the pugs that look most like the ideal description of a pug, can no longer reliably mate on their own, and pug puppies are virtually always delivered by C-section.
Wow! So pugs in the wild would simply not reproduce.
Yeah. Right, they'll never be feral pugs. This was what one pug fancier told me.
So there are thousands of dog cesarean sections every year?
Yeah, there are, and there's also elaborate surgical procedures for inseminating dogs. The most dramatic being, I guess, that you can actually open up the dog, inject semen directly into the reproductive system of the mother. Replace it all and sew it back up, and that's sort of your surest bet to make sure that you're going to have puppies. Also, because oftentimes you're paying, $500, $600, $700 in a stud fee. You're basically buying the semen of someone else's male dog, and you want to make sure when you do that you're giving yourself the best shot of having a litter of puppies.
We'll hear more about the new designer dogs when Dave Davies continues his interview with journalist John Mo'Allam, after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview that Fresh Air's frequent guest host Dave Davies recorded with journalist John Mo'Allam about the new designer dogs. Mo'Allam's article on designer dogs was the cover story of this week's New York Times Magazine.
I was intrigued that one of the breeders that you spoke to, Wallace Havens, had worked out multi-generational formulas for combining 5 or 6 different breeds. He would give them names which didn't disclose which 5 or 6 breeds they were. what was he up to?
Wallace is a guy who is generally credited as quote-unquote inventing the Puggle, which was one of the more popular designer dogs. It kind of peaked about a year and a half ago or so. He really felt like he had invented this thing. He'd been breeding Puggles for about 20 years. And what happened was, as soon as in about the winter of 2005, celebrities started having Puggles and being photographed with them, Jake Gyllenhaal went on, I think it was the Ellen DeGeneres show with a Puggle, and it sort of spiked the Puggle's popularity. And, breeding a Puggle or something that you can call a Puggle is not terribly difficult if you have a Pug and a Beagle around. And what happened was lots of people jumped on this bandwagon and started breeding Puggles and selling them over the internet. There are now, with one small registry service alone, there are something like 200 Puggle breeders on file. One of every 4 litters they register a month is Puggles.
Wow.
And Wallace really felt, I think he felt a little hurt about this. I think he felt like he didn't respect the quality of the Puggles that were being bred. He felt like he bred them in a far better way. He had told me that he'd seen people breeding pugs to other kinds of hound dogs and calling them Puggles. He actually said something like it was giving the Puggle a bad name. And I think these kind of multi-generational crosses that he started in on are a kind of way to stay ahead of the game.
Are breeders regulated at all? Is there any state or federal agency that looks after breeders?
There is in some cases. In terms of on a national scale, there's the USDA. And my understanding is that the USDA is only inspecting people who are selling their dogs not directly to the public, so to pet stores or any other middleman type of situation. If I wanted to breed a few dogs in my backyard and then put up an ad on the internet, as far as I know, I would be more or less immune to any kind of regulation or inspection.
I just have to ask you about a couple more of these clever combinations. One of them you mentioned was the Sharpeys and the Bassets being combined for sharp assets. Is that anything more than a word game?
It is easy to ask the question whether the name comes first in a lot of situations. And it seems like the quirkier the name, the more attention it's going to get to start with, regardless of what the dog itself is like.
Well, I'm sure there's some controversy and issues around this designer dog trend. And it occurred to me that part of the appeal of owning a dog is having a little piece of the natural world in our lives, this creature with its own wants and instincts that you can't change. And to some people, it would seem sort of creepy to be kind of genetically modifying that.
Yeah, it's interesting to what degree the criticisms and the worries and concerns about this are related to the dogs and to the extent that they're related to the people who should be responsible for the dogs. In terms of manipulating dogs themselves, we've been doing that for tens of thousands of years. The name designer dog, in my mind, is a bit of a misnomer, because it's not clear to what extent any of these dogs are really being designed for, with specific goals in mind, which is not to say that those dogs are bad or poorly bred animals. But a lot of the purebred dogs were really just as much of a manipulation of nature. The line between what is natural and what is unnatural in the domestic dog is pretty hazy, if not non-existent altogether. In the Victorian era, when a lot of the purebred dog fancy, as it's called, the people who breed dogs competitively for show, started. They were taking sort of existing breeds of dogs, and they were crossing them, and then inbreeding them, and introducing other breeds to get just what they wanted. That, to me, is every bit as much, if not more, of a design practice.
Is the interest of pet owners in designer dogs related at all to changes in modern lifestyle? I mean, a lot of people who are very, very busy, like cats because they're lower maintenance, are people looking for dogs that they can treat more like cats?
Yeah, I mean, that's essentially what some people told me who I interviewed for the article. What happened in the 80s was that for the first time in America, pet cats were more popular than pet dogs. There were more pet cats. And, when I asked one man, a guy named Bob Viteri, who's the president of a pet products trade group, about this, he basically, put it right back to scoopable litter. He said that was the real clincher, that suddenly a cat, which was something that was seen as self-sufficient, was now even more self-sufficient. We didn't really have to muss around with a smelly litter box as often. And you do see, in the past 20 years, a lot of products that have come out that are basically designed to give a dog the best life possible without us having to change our lifestyle so much.
Like what?
So, if we want to leave the dog at home, but we don't want it to get on our furniture, there are, tons of products, everything to these sort of mildly electrified little mats that you can set up like a little minefield around your living room. So you do see, to me, this just sort of shows that there is this subtle dissatisfaction with having to make a compromise with your dog. I don't think that there's any reason to believe that, a Cockapoo or a Labradoodle or any of the new breeds is going to make that tremendously easier, if at all. But certainly when there's a new dog there, I think people are very optimistic, and they say, well, maybe this is it. Maybe this is finally the perfect dog, the one I've been looking for.
Well, John Moalem, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
John Moalem wrote this week's New York Times Magazine cover story about the new designer dogs. He spoke with Dave Davies, who guest hosts Fresh Air and is a senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News. We'll have pictures of the new designer dogs on our website, freshair.npr.org. And now you can also go to our website for podcasts of Fresh Air. That's freshair.npr.org. I'm Terry Gross.